Leo, what's the trouble? Look at these bills, Fred.
Leo, this is Japanese occupation money.
I know. I'm loaded with it. I'm yen happy.
Say, that's right. I read that you and Danny Kaye spent 2 months entertaining our boys in Japan. How was your trip?
Wonderful, Fred. We flew over 32,000 miles to Manila, Guam, Kwajalein, Okinawa, Yokohama, Tokyo, and Korea.
Say, did you see that city where the first atomic bomb was dropped?
Yes, Fred. We flew over Hiroshima for about half an hour.
It was a shambles, huh?
A shambles? It looked like Ebbets Field after a doubleheader with the Giants.
Well, what about that city where the second bomb landed, Nagasaki?
You know that old song?
The end of World War II brought with it a massive change in the scientific landscape. Two bombs had made all the difference in the world. And now that it was public, weapons testing began in earnest with an accompanying barrage of publicity and Cold War justification. In January 1946, the Navy announced Operation Crossroads.
Thus the natives expressed to the people of the United States their welcome. Despite the fact that the atoll of Bikini may be utterly destroyed come July the 1st.
Bikini Island, what is now called Micronesia, was the target. Its 167 residents were relocated by the Navy.
All right now, James, will you tell them that the United States government now wants to turn this great...
In this soundtrack from a government film, we hear U.S. Navy Commodore Ben Wyatt meeting beneath coconut trees beside a picturesque lagoon on Bikini Island.
How it will sound. 20 seconds. We do not know how it's going to sound, but 42,000 men here are one.
Bikini Island would host the largest man-made explosion in history. Some years later, a hydrogen bomb, codenamed Bravo, would explode here with 1,000 times the force of the Hiroshima bomb and vaporize the entire test island and parts of two others, sucking them 20 miles into the tropic sky. Over the next 12 years, the United States tested almost 100 weapons in the Pacific.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
In 1946, Winston Churchill, no longer Britain's Prime Minister, addressed this gathering at Westminster College, Missouri, President Harry Truman's alma mater. Winston Churchill's presentation was titled Sinews of Peace.
Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere.
Programs at this time to bring you a special news bulletin. President Truman has just announced that Soviet Russia has the atomic bomb. The announcement was made with dramatic...
Well, now you come to a new development, a new aspect, science and secrets. Science has no secrets. The scientists all tell you the secrets may be engineering, but not scientific. And, of course, the top scientists, Einstein and the others, and Niels Bohr, suggested, too, that all these discoveries be shared, because they would find it anyway. The scientists of the world have a fraternity, a fraternal feeling. The idea of it being a science having secrets is sheer nonsense. Ask Philip Morrison about that. Don't ask me. Ask the scientists about it.
What did you tell the public?
By the end of 45, we had evolved a certain number of ideas in concert and had put these into slogan form. So it turns out these mottos or slogans are awfully good today, which I think is more than we could have expected after 40 years. And they said, first, there is no secret, by which we were saying everyone will have this, in particular the Russians.
The Cold War was beginning to congeal. The Soviet Union had invaded Czechoslovakia. Berlin was under blockade. The communist Chinese were moving across China. Pressure grew enormously for Edward Teller's superbomb, a hydrogen bomb thousands of times more powerful than the bombs dropped on Japan. Testing moved to the mainland United States to Nevada, where it's still conducted today. The first nuclear detonation occurred there in 1951. A 1 kiloton bomb dropped from an Air Force plane onto Frenchman Flat, a desolate valley 65 miles northwest of Las Vegas.
Since 1951, these barren hills have echoed to 31 atomic detonations.
In the 50s, when I was a child, it was not a backdrop. The bombs went off in our backyard and rivaled the sunrise.
Mary Manning is a journalist at the Las Vegas Sun, where she's worked for most of her life.
In fact, there were two sunrises always. We'd see that purplish-orange burst in the air, and often see the pink clouds hovering over from the radioactive fallout. And we actually did our duck and cover drills in school, just like a fire drill, except you go under the desk and hide your head. To the blasts, we used to time them to the blasts at the test site. Those flashes in the sky have been burned into my brain forever. I won't get rid of them ever.
Duck and cover. He did what we all must learn to do.
You
and you
and you
and you.
Duck
and cover.
It was along about 1951 when the government first started this testing down in Nevada, and everyone around Cedar and Parowan that you talked to was really excited about it. It was really a big thing, big deal. And we thought that we was going to be part of the national defense and that we was going to be able to help out in some small way in developing the bombs. And we just felt a patriotic feeling towards your government that we was being of some use. Well, anyway,
Isaac Nelson is one of almost 5 million Mormons living in Utah, not far from the Nevada test site. He's retired, works as a security guard at the local police station in Cedar City, Utah. Isaac Nelson remembers the day atomic testing began in the United States.
Put up on top of these high towers, 300 or 400 or 500 feet in the air. I've never seen them, but I've read about them. And they would explode these above-ground bombs, and some of them they would drop the bombs out of airplanes. And these were the type of bombs, these above-ground bombs, were the ones that were picking up the dust from the desert floor, and they would go up and they would form this mushroom cloud, which in turn would form the radiation cloud, which would drift over St. George and Cedar and Panaca and Pioche and various communities here in southern Utah and Nevada. I recall that the people, when they first started these tests, were all really excited. In the morning that they had the first test, there was dozens of people who'd get in their car and they'd drive out west of town here, the other side of the stockyard, and walk up on the hillside, and they had a clear view across the valley for about 10, 15 miles. And we'd sit there huddled up early in the early morning, and along about 5 o'clock, why, that would be long before daylight, here would come this blast, and the whole sky would just light up with a red-orange flash. And if you'd have had a newspaper there, you could have been able to read a newspaper by it. It was so brilliant, and still that bomb was exploded a good 100 miles, I guess, away from us.
Isaac Nelson recalls watching a fallout cloud from a bomb test slowly drift over Cedar City. His wife, Olita, was to die from a brain tumor. But before she did, Isaac recalled an incident that made him think fallout could be the cause of her slowly declining health.
That headache just kept reoccurring. But anyway, it went on for a period of, 3 weeks or a month or such a matter, and one day I was sitting in the living room. That was in another house before we built this one. And I was sitting in the living room, and she was in the bathroom washing her head. And all at once, she let out the most ungodly scream you could imagine. I couldn't imagine what was wrong with her, and I rushed in there, and her hair had slipped right off from about halfway back on her head and was in the wash basin. And she had just beautiful black, shiny hair. And it was just black. It was just, when it was in the sun, it just glistened, just almost green like a raven's wing. It was beautiful hair, long hair. But you can imagine the reaction that a woman would have to lose all of her hair and see it there laying in the wash basin. And she was just in a state of panic.
During the 1950s, the public health dangers posed by radioactive fallout from test explosions in the atmosphere began to be appreciated. Scientists and doctors like Nobel Prize winner Linus Pauling applied pressure on the government.
Radioactive fallout causes damage to the pool of human germplasm that does result in the birth of an additional number of defective children. I have estimated that the amount of increase in the mutation rate as a result of radioactive fallout carried on at the present rate is 1%. Testing at the present rate leads to a 1% increase in mutation rate, a 1% increase in the number of defective children who will be born in the future.
Then in 1963, President John Kennedy, under tremendous public pressure to reduce radioactive fallout, proposed a cessation by the United States and the Soviet Union in nuclear weapons testing. So evolved the Limited Test Ban Treaty. Weapons testing
this
went underground.
Can be a step towards freeing the world from the fears and dangers of radioactive fallout. Continued, unrestricted testing by the nuclear powers, joined in time by other nations, which may be less adept in limiting pollution, will increasingly contaminate the air that all of us must breathe. Even then, the number of children and grandchildren with cancer in their bones, with leukemia in their blood, or with poison in their lungs might seem statistically small to some in comparison with natural health hazards. But this is not a natural health hazard, and it is not a statistical issue. The loss of even one human life, or the malformation of even one baby, who may be born long after all of us have gone, should be of concern to us all.
You see, when President Kennedy stopped exploding nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, he did so because the mothers of America and the Soviet Union saw that their children were being killed with strontium 90.
Retired Admiral Jean LaRocque of the Washington-based Center for Defense Information.
And there was a hue and cry from particularly mothers that we want those nuclear weapons explosions stopped. They were stopped and put underground. Since they've been underground, the mothers have not been so interested anymore. People have almost forgotten about nuclear weapons testing. And if you want to bring about a change in a country like the United States, then the people must speak out. It's a little more subtle than having nuclear weapons exploding overhead, but it's equally as important to stop nuclear weapons testing underground as it was to stop explosions in the atmosphere.
I interviewed Bertrand Russell. I wish I'd interviewed Einstein, but it was too late. But in Russell's case, he was saying, and he said this many times, he spoke of USSR, of course, the two antagonists, the two superpowers. He says, they have to realize that their common humanity is far transcends overwhelmingly their ideological differences. And he says it, and others say it in different forms. But this village is now smaller than ever, this global village we call the Earth. And as Martin Luther King did put it, we'll either live together as men or die together as fools. And it comes to that. It comes to idiocy or sanity. Einstein, come back to Einstein. We have to come back to Einstein because it was he who split the... It was he who came up with a theory that made all this possible. And it was he who saw President Franklin Roosevelt to get the okay for the Manhattan Project, who was horrified when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. He never expected the bomb to be dropped on human beings. And toward the end, he said, we've got to think anew. And then think anew means think beyond, as he put it, you know, national boundaries and flags and martial music. Everything has changed. Nothing will ever be the same. We know that scientifically, technologically, we have taken the quantum leap. What he's really saying, we've got to take a quantum leap in thinking, too.
This program was produced and narrated by Andrew Phillips. Production assistance from Arlene Krebs and Amy Goodman. Technical production, Stephen Erickson and Peter Beauchamp. Special thanks, Studs Terkel. This has been an Investigations radio project. This program was made available by the Center for Defense Information. CDI publishes the Defense Monitor, and its address is Box 141, Washington, D.C., 20044.